This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century,
join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Everybody, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Listener, it's good to have you here, wherever here is. I'm joined today, this is Matt Tevye, by the way, and I'm joined today by my friends, Ben Sternke. You're looking good, Ben.
Thank you.
You have a nice glow about you. Just got back from sabbatical. Probably had a good night's sleep.
Got that sabbatical glow, decent night's sleep, beard glistening.
Yeah.
No, I don't know if it's glistening, but
anyway. Looks like you got a air conditioned room there. You're in.
Yeah. Air conditioning. Although it's beautiful. It's like 72 today. So you don't hardly need it here in Indianapolis. And, I'll also have you know that I smell good. So That's just neither here nor there, but
all right. I'm going to text Raina, your daughter right now, and ask her to creep into your room and sniff you.
Oh, she's not home.
All right.
My wife is home. So
yeah, listener. Hey,
We all have nicknames, by the way. Did you realize this?
What do you mean?
Matt, Ben, Christy. What's your real name? Is it Matthew?
Oh.
Yes.
Matthew Anthony.
Matthew Jacob.
I don't know.
Matthew Jacob Tevye.
Jacob.
Yep.
Jacob.
Matthew Jacob Tevye and Benjamin
Rockefeller Sternke.
Does anybody know? Benjamin James? That's not a bad guess. I'd take Benjamin
what
James.
What is it?
Do either of you know my middle name? No.
I do. I just don't want to like publicly announce
it. I know
it.
What it should be.
So you don't want to dox me.
Right.
It's Eric. Benjamin Eric. Sternke.
Benjamin Eric. Uh-huh. And do you know mine?
Your full name is Christina. Christine?
No. Christine.
Christine. Okay. Christine.
LaToya.
Rebecca.
So close, Matt.
Okay.
Lynn.
Christine. Lynn. I knew that.
Christine Lynn.
I knew that. All right.
It's a little bit difficult with the two N's there. Christine Lynn.
That's good.
All right. Well,
Christy's here too, by the way, everybody. That's the voice you heard. We thought we'd do a little bit of a redux or a summary/extension episode, trading off of the interview we did last week with Andrew Whited on his book, American Idolatry. So this podcast might make more sense if you listen to that podcast first. But there was so much we talked with him about Christian nationalism and the Christian response to Christian nationalism that we thought it would be good to maybe spend more time in what do we do as Christians, as people who are living in the United States and love Jesus? How do we live our Christian life in relationship to the rising threat or heresy or danger of Christian nationalism. So
all three.
All three. So I took some notes. I want to like just throw them out here for conversation and as fodder for dialogue. And I'll start by just naming in the last half of the book, Andrew talks about three idols that compose Christian nationalism. He talks about the idol of fear, the idol of violence, and the idol of power. So here's what I thought I'd do. I thought we could take one by one, and I would just give a brief, here's what he means by fear, here's what he means by violence, that kind of thing. And then we can talk through what would it look like to embody not an idol of Christian nationalism, but to embody a virtue or a communal commitment that would oppose it or subvert it or prophetically witness to it or even undo it.
Mm. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I think that'd be good. And let me say, just for our listeners, why I think this is helpful. Towards the end of that other interview, we asked Andrew, like, what can we do? You know, and how do we talk about these things with people who seem to be, you know, they've taken the wrong pill. That's the red one or the blue one. I can't remember, but they seem to be under the spell of Christian nationalism. How do we, you know, talk to them and that kind of thing? And one of the things Andrew said that I think is really key and important is that there has to be, in addition to any conversations we may have with people, there has to be some embodied commitment to living in a different way. Mm-hmm. So this has to transcend. This can't just be ideas that we argue about. And we can't just say, hey, Christian nationalism is a bad idea. Here's a better idea. All of that kind of conversation has to be rooted in actual like communal commitments, actual embodied concrete solidarities. And so I think that's what we're aiming for in this episode is what does that look like for us? Like, what can we actually do to create those kinds of embodied solidarities that can bear witness to the heresy of Christian nationalism and maybe the truth and goodness of the gospel instead? So,
yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Let's get in.
All right. The first one is fear. Andrew talks about the ways that Christian nationalists stir up and drum up, create, manufacture, amplify fear as a way of galvanizing and motivating people to take up quote arms, to be on their side, to galvanize a voting block, if you will, right? And the fear is usually about what other people are doing to take away the privilege and the power of white Christians. So we've got the state, right? The creeping state taking away our rights and freedoms, right? They want to take away your guns. They want to take away other liberties that you have, right? The fear of immigrants, right? So we've got, I don't want to put a trigger warning on this podcast, but we've got lots of language about the demonization of non-white, non-European immigrants into our country and how they are, lots of slurs are used. They're linked with drugs, right? They're linked with crime and those kinds of things. The fear of economic woes, right? The fear of losing majority status. There's this conspiracy theory, I guess, called the replacement theory, that non-white, non-Christian people are seeking to replace you, which has its origins in Nazi Germany, the Third Reich, right? This is the same ethnic disease logic that fueled and fomented the Holocaust.
Yeah.
So there's this fear, racial fears, immigrant fears, or religious fears, right? Muslims, quote, the Jews. You hear a lot of this language. So first of all, let me just say, like, have you guys heard, is this a surprise to you, or is this something that you're familiar with and you hear about? Christy?
Yeah, no, it's every day, every week. Like, people use terminology or articulate their fears in the way that they talk about all of these things. And it's not just adults. Like, I mean, I have kids and I hear other kids and kids talk about it. And I think because they're hearing it from their parents too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It is definitely all over the place. And you can tell it's what motivates a lot of action, politically, is people being afraid that they're going to lose something that they used to have in the past, that's being threatened, threatened in the future. And I think ultimately I do think it comes down to, I've thought a lot about this, like, what is animating this? And I think it's ultimately like a fear of death. that people have, right? And so it's a natural thing. I think that's why it's so powerful. I think it's a natural, you know, lizard brain kind of amygdala kind of thing, where because we have because our lives seem to us consist in our status among people, our wealth, you know, our ability to, you know, put food on the table, our ability to, you know, have status with other people, our privilege, our power in society, all of that kind of thing. We think that's what our life consists in. And so all you have to do to get people really riled up is claim that someone is trying to take that away from them. And that this deep instinctive fear of death rises to the surface, and people are willing to do all kinds of stuff to avoid death. Because it feels like that's what's at stake, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting though. You see, there's like, here's one of the ways you know it's idolatry and not necessarily a principled position, because you see incredible reliance upon stirring up fear, telling people to be afraid, telling people to get angry. And then when a worldwide pandemic hits and people are like, hey, the way that we can stave off the rising infection rate is do what doctors have been doing for over a century, because they know how germs work, and wear a mask. And people decide that they're not going to wear a mask because they believe they have faith over fear.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. And so there's almost a psychosis attached to this. Right.
Yeah. Something that could actually kill you is something that doesn't register as a threat, whereas something that has very little chance of killing you registers as like DEFCON 5.
Yeah. 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 And so there's other incongruities or inconsistencies we could name. But the point of this podcast, though, is not to just elucidate and sort of describe how awful things are. It's all too fun to do that sometimes, but to press on and say, if we're not to live in fear, right?
Right.
Like church fathers, there's an entire book where a church father is on his way to Rome to be crucified, executed. And he's writing letters to churches as he goes, and he's rejoicing that he gets to share in the sufferings of Christ. So there's a thoroughgoing long history that fear is not our birthright as Christians, even in the face of an evil state or an evil empire, that we could actually come to see our sufferings, if there are any, which is debatable, as participation in the sufferings of Christ, right? So then what do we do? How do we, as Christians who don't want to be Christian nationalists, how do we oppose or have a counter character to the one that wants to prey upon and use fear to consolidate privilege and power? Well, I was thinking about this, and I want to throw out something for conversation. And it occurs to me that the fear of the state, the fear of immigrants, the fear of crime, drug, there's a lot of scapegoating happening, right? There's a lot of other people want what's yours. Yeah? They want your guns, they want your house, they want your way of life. And I've noticed that this tends to distance us from those people that we're told to be afraid of. So what I'm proposing is, maybe instead of a spirit of fear, we move towards scapegoated, marginalized, quote, dangerous people with proximity and solidarity.
Yeah. You know, Matt, when we label, the more we're able to label people, the more we cut them off and can say whatever we want about people and not even treat them as humans, honestly. We dehumanize people. And so I think this whole moving across the barrier, actually knowing names and faces and loving people, then you're not afraid.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reminded, Ben, of the mosque that is in our town.
Yeah, I thought of that too.
We moved here right when the mosque, we moved here right when sort of the anti-Muslim thing was kind of kicking back in. I don't know. I feel like there was a lot of anti-Muslim stuff around 9/11.
Right.
And that died off a bit, but then it came back up in the mid 2010s, and we intentionally moved towards this mosque to befriend them, because I had a particular responsibility as a white Christian to do my part to have proximity and solidarity with them. And they put on, this mosque puts on, they have a school with kids, and they put on get to know Islam sort of events with a meal. And Ben, I don't know what your thoughts are about this, but at least 3/4 of this event where the kids do a presentation on Islam and a history of it and what it's about, at least 3/4 of the event is, we don't hate you. Mm-hmm. We're not a threat to you. Mm-hmm. Islam is about peace. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be afraid of us. Please don't see us as your enemy. Like over and over and over.
Yeah.
Am I remembering that correctly, Ben?
Yeah, I was really struck by that. I remember feeling sad about the, I was like, they obviously know that this is necessary. Like it's a survival mechanism for them, you know, to be so hospitable. I mean, they were so hospitable, so gracious.
Yeah.
They fed us, like they, you know, invited us to, is iftar? Is that the meal at the end of each day of Ramadan? Anyway, I might have that wrong. But they invited us to that as well. Anyway, they're very generous, very gracious, very hospitable. Mm. And part of me was sad because I figure they are probably like that. A lot of them are immigrants and come from immigrant populations in Syria and other places. But also just the fact that their openness, their generosity, their hospitality was also like necessary. It's necessary for them to be very open, very blatant about it for their own survival, just because they know how white Western kind of Christians look at them. And so I remember being struck by that as well.
Yeah. Our connection there was a doctor. And a few times, I mean, I feel like, Ben, we haven't done practically anything I'm going to tell you this, listener, but it's not a reflection upon what Ben and I have done.
Right.
Our friend Salah said, I so appreciate the way that you've loved us, and we've reached out a couple times when there's been violence against Muslims in the US or a bombing somewhere in a mosque, just to say, are you guys doing okay? Do you need anything? Mm-hmm. And like in tears, Salah has said publicly how much that has meant to him and before his whole mosque. And I feel like that was nothing. It was an email and like a quick conversation. But to me, it's indicative of how fragile and scared these people are, and how just like a tiny bit of charity or kindness means the world to them.
I think that, you know, what we did there in that example is more on the proximity level than the solidarity level. I wanted to talk a bit about both of those words that you used, Matt. I think those are both, they're different, but they're both important. But I think, you know, proximity is the easiest one, right? Proximity is, like you said, we hardly did a thing. And so it's easy to kind of practice proximity. But I think the power of proximity is that, like any message now, like if you attend one of those events and you know those people, now if you get another message that's like the Muslims are coming to, you know, bomb us and eradicate us from the earth, all of a sudden that rings very false, right? It's like, wait a second, I know Muslims like that, like what, you know? So I think that's the power of proximity. But I wonder, I don't know, maybe we could talk a bit about what we mean by solidarity. What would that look like? You know, and how is it different from proximity? Do you guys have any ideas?
Other than it takes a lot of intentionality for both.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know you said it's a small thing,
mm-hmm.
but I bet our listeners are thinking, but it also takes intentionality.
Yeah.
Even for your proximity.
Yeah.
You had email, right?
Right. Yeah.
So solidarity is even more so being intentional.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Like arm in arm. Like what does that really look like?
So if I could use a biblical example. When Paul's writing to 1 Corinthians, just thought of this, so hopefully it'll make sense by the time I get done saying something. When Paul's writing to 1 Corinthians,
around the clock.
He's dealing with some factions there, And he's got a famous line where he says, I've become all things to all people so I might win them to Christ. You guys are familiar with that line.
Yeah.
But if you back up, what he's describing is that he has decided not to receive gifts or benefaction from wealthy people in the church so that he has to do their bidding. So he's intentionally kept himself unencumbered from social arrangements or relationships that would put him at odds or prejudiced against some people and privileged to others. So basically what he's saying is, I've kept myself free to stand with whoever needs to be stood with in order that they might know Jesus.
Yeah.
And so I think we start with asking questions about what are our commitments and social arrangements? Who do they privilege and who do they prejudice against? You know, how do we arrange? And so he's talking about money, which mm-hmm. still is one of the ways that that happens.
Sure.
But I think Paul's logic there is, I wanted to be in solidarity with all of you.
Yeah.
Not some of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
I think that part of what Paul does there in 1 Corinthians, it's not like both sides-ing like we sometimes see. Yeah. You know, people do like, well, I don't want to be, you know, I want to be above the fray and not necessarily throw my hat in the ring with, you know, either one of these sides. But I think the difference there is that it's not like for Paul, he didn't want to side with the powerful against those without power. And so his decision, what he was unable to do was stand with, like you said, those who need to be stood with, which is those without power, those who are being marginalized, those who are being scapegoated and excluded. And so I think that's the difference. I think that both sides-ing instinct is not an instinct to stand with the marginalized. Rather, it's an instinct to remove yourself from needing to do anything, you know, about the situation, that you have this privileged perspective from which you can just say, oh yeah, there's issues on both sides of this issue, which in effect privileges the powerful, because you're not putting your body on the line with those who are being hurt by power. So I think that's the difference. And that, in my mind, that's what solidarity means, is like, how do I put my body on the line in such a way that if they're going to come after these people, I'm probably going to get caught up in this as well. They're probably coming after me too. Because I'm known to be, right, somebody who is, or I am actually physically there, you know, with the people who are being harmed. And that's still very deeply challenging to me. To know how to do that in my everyday life, you know, with a church community. That's a caveat, but that's what I envision when I think of solidarity, is just like, yeah, we're throwing a lot in, and you know, so if they come for those people, I guess they're coming for me too, you know, whatever that looks like, however that looks. So.
Yeah. And this kind of, I mean, maybe just a star or something, but I guess I just want to name, like, I understand that we are three white people talking about this, and we don't have other people being able to like speak into that. I just want to name that. But I think this also, like, this fear also brings us to the second one, which is violent power, right? This violence, war, guns, hate, persecution, this worldly power that people are really being harmful, killing people because of the power that they have. Can you just speak a little bit about that? And kind of, I know, Matt, you've kind of been chewing on this. So tell us more about what you think about this.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Andrew's point that the second idol, like Chrissy said, is violence. And that includes, you know, war, guns, hate, persecution. And there's violence to inciting fear against people as well. So these aren't neat, clean categories, but, you know, particularly we see this in some expressions of justifying. I mean, I've seen memes going around that talk about how if Jesus had the Second Amendment, he wouldn't have been crucified, you know? So and it's like, that's like a celebrated meme, right? It's like,
so many problems with that theologically, just all kinds of, it's just like, where do you even start?
Right. So violence then is the power that makes the world work. And we see this kind of, I think we see this maybe, distilled or, the quintessential example of this would be like the January 6th insurrection, right? We didn't get our way. And so we're going to use violence to force, to coerce our way.
Yeah.
And I still think sometimes how close that was to succeeding. And, you know, and maybe not a complete overthrow of the government, but somebody dying.
Right.
You know, like Mike Pence, like dude barely made it out.
That's what their intention was.
Yeah. And so then violence is the logic whereby we get things done, make things happen. We use force, worldly force to.
Yeah.
You see this, Ben?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a quote recently actually of, you know, a politician talking about it, basically openly advocating for, you know, force is the only way to get things done. You know, when you've got all this, I mean, what they name as corruption, you know, that kind of thing. And I think it is, it's a really tempting idol. I like that Andrew talks about them as idols too, because ultimately violence is, it's the, you know, inside of the Christian nationalist imagination, the violence is used to a good end, right? We're trying to like make America great again. We're trying to do something good here in the world. And the last recourse, but it still is a recourse, is that, well, at the end of the day, we can force people to do what is good and right. And I think that's the heart of violence and the power that it sort of, and like you said, these all kind of overlap because violence is a form of power, which is Andrew's third idol. But yeah, it's everywhere. And it's in a lot of our assumptions about how to do good things in the world.
Yeah. So then I thought maybe the antidote or the corollary that helps us push back against this is love. And maybe if I can use some adjectives to qualify, I would say the anti-violent power of love. Now I'm taking the word anti-violence from the book that we read, Field Guide to Nonviolence, that we read it and we talked about on this podcast. And that was one of the forms of nonviolence that I think it was Wernz and Kramer talked about in that book. What I liked about anti-violence rather than nonviolence is anti-violence seems to be more assertive and active, whereas nonviolence is simply not doing something.
Right.
Yeah. So anti implies that you're doing something. Mm-hmm. Whereas non-violence is more of a I'm not doing something. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, but flesh that out for us a little bit. Like, give us an example of like modern day 2023, what this really looks like.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give you an example, and it's from my friend. I'll call her Mary. Mary's a black woman who's married a white guy, and they have biracial kids, black kids who pass. They're scripted as black, and they live in a mixed race neighborhood. And one night there was a group of, I may have told this story, but there was a group of teenagers that were on the corner with music and dancing. And they were like, they were drinking.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And she saw them, it was late, and she knows that there's people in her neighborhood who, if they see black teenage boys doing those kinds of things, they're going to call the police.
Yep.
And she knows, as a black woman, that she can't trust the police. And when the police see a group of teenage black boys, that all hell often breaks loose. Right. Mm-hmm. And so she wants to protect these boys from the violence of the police. And so she called a neighborhood mom, another mom that she knows, and she said, "Hey, we need to break up this dance party because somebody's going to get hurt. Something bad is going to happen." And so she said she went out there in her t-shirt and shorts, no bra, and Mary is very well endowed woman. So she's got these, she's got no bra on, a t-shirt, she's got this other mom, and they go out there with their own music and they start dancing. And the teenagers laugh at them, right? Laugh at them and disperse. Mm. To me, this is a creative way of not only policing her own community, but protecting people from violence with creative anti-violence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember all the technical definitions, because I think it's like a specific, is like a research book, wasn't it? And it was like a specific movement with specific commitments.
Feminists.
Anyway, all that to say, I can't remember the specifics of, what they mean when they say anti-violence, but I do like the term as well because, one of the other ways that people have sometimes qualified nonviolence is like nonviolent action. They've tried to say, like, it's not that we just opt out of anything, right? I mean, think about like the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement was filled with nonviolent action. You could label it maybe as anti-violence. Again, I don't know the technical specifications there, but it was filled with all kinds of action, right? Where people were prepared to suffer. People were prepared to, but they were also prepared, trained very well to not retaliate in the same kind as the brutality that the police were going to inflict, and other people. And I think that sometimes when we think of just nonviolence, like the refraining from violence, you almost have like the picture of the white moderate, right? In your mind that Martin Luther King Jr. talked about, but it's the person who's sort of like, hey, I'm not going to go out there and like, join, I'm not going to shout at black people, not to join our schools, but neither am I going to march, with Martin Luther King Jr. and advocate for, their civil rights. I'm going to back out, I'm going to back out of the fight. And so I think that, that's right. That the antidote to violence as an idol can't just be, refusing to participate in the conflict. I think we have
opting
to have
out.
Creative. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There has to be creative ways of, anti-violent love, nonviolent action that exposes, the violence of those who are perpetrating it. And also maybe creates an imagination for a new way, a better way, disrupts it.
Yeah.
But every situation is going to demand something different.
I mean, another example comes to mind of John chapter 8. Jesus confronts people with rocks who are intending to do violence with nonviolent love, anti-violent love, right? That's solidarity. He puts his body in between, right? The threat and the vulnerable person.
Yeah.
And he calls the threatening people to account.
Yeah.
At a great cost to himself, right? It could have ended in his death and hers, but it didn't.
Yeah.
So I think we lack the creative imagination for how love works. And it's partly because even if, listener, you aren't a Christian nationalist, fear and violence are such powerful idols of the age that they have colonized our minds.
That's right.
They've colonized our minds. When I hear Mary tell her story about the creativity she used to protect those black boys from what she thought would be police violence, mm-hmm. it just never occurred to me that you could ever do that. Why not? Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
And so that's one of 10,000 ways I think my imagination has been compromised.
Yeah.
With how violence is. Let me tell one more story about this. Can I?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Please.
My son wanted to see Oppenheimer. He's 14. I looked up reviews, and there's a woman that's topless like three times in Oppenheimer. So my spiritual formation, my moral formation cares way more about a woman's breasts being shown on a screen than any violence done on a screen. Mm-hmm. And I noticed, it's about the making of an atomic bomb that killed 200,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I'm like, I don't know, there's some breasts. Mm-hmm. And I just noticed like my entire moral compass has been set to ignore yeah. almost all violence except for really gratuitous, disgusting violence. Right?
Yeah.
It's a huge kairos for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important to remember and name, you know, that the fear and violence, and then we'll talk about power here in just a second. But all of those things that we see displayed in Christian nationalism, it's not like, you know, it's not like those of us even who maybe think of Christian nationalism as like terrible, it's not like those same powers are not at work within us. It's not as though we're automatically immune from those things. And so I think that's an important thing for us, you know, to remember is the people that we see out there who are maybe participating in Christian nationalism are, you know, in many ways just like us. You know, they've just, as we have to learn to name and see and repent of, you know, these idols in ourselves as well. What were you gonna say, Christine?
Yeah, I would go so far as to say it's not that they're maybe just not at, like they could be at work in us. I would say they are at work
sure.
in yeah. us. Like mm-hmm. we have to be aware, like have our eyes open to like the big and small ways that fear and power and violence like do show itself. And maybe, and I think part of the problem is like we can excuse ourselves. I could excuse myself because I can say like, well, I'm not a Christian nationalist. Like I'm not in that category. Yep. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have fear and power and violence at work in my heart and in my life.
Yes.
That needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Well, let's talk about the third one. Or go ahead, Matt. You can say something else.
Yeah, there's something, there's a thought that's just beyond the reaches of my prefrontal cortex. And it's something like what you just said, Christy. I don't know a way to stand as Christ would stand with Christian nationalists unless we can see ourselves in them too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you just did. Look, mm-hmm. I've got cancer. I've got skin cancer with fear and violence, and it's all through your body. And I know how it's ravaging you. And I want this cancer gone too. Mm-hmm. Like that's the kind of, I think if we could talk about solidarity, even towards people who are Christian nationalists with opposing them, but opposing the cancer of Christian nationalism that right. also threatens us too.
Yes. Yeah.
Instead of opposing them, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think this is what Jesus is getting at when he talks about loving our enemies. I just preached on this, you know, last Sunday.
Let us have it, Pastor.
Hey. so it's on my mind, is my point. This is why Jesus says we love our enemies, right? And Paul, it was paired in the lectionary that we're using right now. It was paired with Paul talking about in Ephesians, putting on the armor of Christ. And mentioning, you know, before he talks about the various ways that we fight, which I think are fascinating, you know, it's we tell the truth, we live righteously, you know, we're prepared to proclaim good news, right? All of these things that we're prepared to do, we have faith in God to liberate us and all of these things. But he says our fight is not against flesh and blood. So You know, it's not against people. It's against principalities, powers. And one way of, a modern way of talking about that, I think, is systems. These systems that dominate our imaginations and make us convinced, for example, that, you know, my life really is being threatened by all these immigrants coming in, or, you know, these Muslims down the street, or whatever it might be. Like, there is, I think there is some kind of human solidarity that we need to find with people who are like, yeah, I know what it's like to be afraid. I know what it's like to feel the temptation to give into that fear and to protect myself with violence. I get it. But hey, there's a better way. You know, let's go together. I think that's part of what it means to love our enemies, is to call them into that, from that place of empathy and solidarity with another human being who's afraid.
Yes.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
Let's get back to the show. Let's go to the third one. The third one is power. And so we've done fear and then violence and now power. And when Andrew talks about power in the book, he spends a lot of time focusing on how Christians align themselves with worldly power, there's a facet. So here's one artifact of that. When Roe v. Wade passed in the early 70s, Christianity Today ran op-eds about Christian positions on abortion. And there's some very famous evangelical theologians who argued not the strict pro-life position we hear today. There was a great variety of opinions about abortion. We've had Mako Nagasawa on our on our podcast talking about that, right? But there were certain shifts in the culture that happened in the 60s that then in the 70s freaked Christians out, having to do with feminism and white supremacy, desegregation of schools, threatening to take away the tax exempt status of schools that wouldn't integrate, et cetera, et cetera. Then there was this consolidation of power and a move to like galvanize Christians under one political umbrella, right? Mm-hmm. So in the 50s, Roman Catholic, I mean, JFK almost didn't get elected because people believed that the Pope was going to be calling the shots. Yeah. And the people that believed that weren't Roman Catholics. It was white Protestants who had a virulent anti-Catholic bias. Yeah. So going from like 1960 with a virulent anti-Catholic bias to less than 20 years later, where Roman Catholics and conservative evangelicals were in bed together politically, was a huge shift, right?
Yeah.
So he talks about in this book, sort of that process of the politicizing of the Christian faith in a partisan way in the United States for consolidation of power to stand against really what were liberation or civil rights movements, right? Mm-hmm. As a response to that. Yeah. And so in this power section, he talks about white supremacy, but we could add gender injustice or economic injustice or ableism, et cetera, which this is a power that wants to divide and dominate, right? There's some people who get to have privilege and power and other people who don't. There's some people who get to come into this building because they're stairs, and there's some people who live on wheels and can't get in, right? Mm-hmm. Christy, this is something that happened. This is apropos of nothing, but hey, let's go with it. I walk into our church 30 minutes before we're starting on Sunday, and there's a man in a wheelchair sitting in the back of our chapel. like right in the middle of the row. Okay. Never seen it before, just listening. And I'm doing stuff, and a friend of ours, or one of our vestry members, Donna, I grabbed her and I said, "Hey, did you go meet that guy over there?" She said, "Yes, his name is Hank, and he is in the neighborhood, and he likes to go into buildings with ramps." And he said, our building had a ramp. So he thought he would come into this building and see what this building was about, see what was in here, what was going on. And he sat there. He was sat through half our service. He listened to Ben's sermon and split. So I don't know.
Who knows what that was about.
He was going to go love his enemy. That's right.
I can't wait. I'm going to go
do it. But I think for white, affluent, able-bodied people, we don't typically think of access as power.
Right.
Because we have access to most everything. Now, Christy, you've told some of your story on this podcast about how being in male-centric church spaces,
yeah,
you felt a lack of access to power that guys couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even just meetings, you know, where you're in a meeting and people are like, "Oh, we're able to share our opinion." And I'm like, "Well, that's only because you're asking only the men to share their opinion. This isn't actually open to everybody."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they don't even see that.
They can't see it because most white men, able-bodied, affluent people have access to everything.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right. We live in a world that's
culture's been built and shaped and normed for us. Right.
Yeah.
And so, but that comes with a cost, because then women and disabled bodies and sexual minorities and racial minorities, they don't have access to the same things we do.
Yeah.
And they know it.
Yeah.
Right? Because they look for buildings with ramps.
Mm-hmm.
Which I never do. I don't have to.
No. It's not a consideration.
So what's the antidote then, Matt?
Ramps. Build what's lots of ramps. We're going to build ramps.
Everywhere.
Answer to injustice. More ramps. Yep.
I think if that power is about consolidating and subjugating, I think then the antidote is distribution and repair. Mm-hmm. It's just reparation. And these are all the metaphors that we spiritualize have real world material meaning in Jesus' day. Paying back, restoring, liberating, healing, redeeming, forgiving. All of these things are about real world injustices being righted.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the ways, the gift I want to give my white Christian group is to rematerialize these spiritual abstractions that keep us as, we don't have anything to offer the world except for some kind of spiritual escape. Mm-hmm. And I think our spirituality is too important to be relegated to some abstract realm in the heavenly places that doesn't do anything here today. Now, I'm not discounting new creation, but I actually think new creation is tied to this creation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a thread.
Ben, you preached your thing on Sunday. Now I'm preaching.
Yeah. That's
so, we better righteous be careful. Reparation.
Christy's going to start preaching.
Right. That I'm all for that. Righteous reparation. What do you guys think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, it just even in my story, right, with the injustice that I've experienced in my life, I'm in a situation now where my boss, I think, is doing reparations. Like, he hasn't mistreated me. Mm-hmm. But as a white man, he is doing reparations on my behalf. That is bringing great healing to my heart.
Could you share some of that? Like, what tangibly, what is he doing that you experience as elevating and repairing things for you?
Yeah, even as simple things as, like, you know, I preached 2 weeks ago, and this past Sunday he preached, and then he gives a shout out of, like, if you haven't heard Christy's sermon, like, this was powerful and the Lord worked in and through her.
Yeah.
That seems super simple and probably like silly for you guys to hear. Like, that's a simple thing I could do. But the reality of him publicly, like, just being kind to me honestly brings me to tears. Yeah. Like, it kind of blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. What a contrast from having your sermons policed and edited.
Yeah.
To having no editing, no policing, and then public affirmation and esteem.
Yeah.
I think one thing that's important maybe to point out in this, you know, he gave several examples of different ways that power works for people and doesn't work for other people. And maybe the two extremes would be white supremacy, which the point I'm trying to make here is that malevolence is not required for injustice to take place. So anyway, put a pin in that. And what I'm noticing is that white supremacy, for example, was an ideology that was created in order to justify greed and exploitation, right? So why is it okay for us to go, you know, to Africa and enslave these people and take all of the resources and use them to build our own stuff, you know, in Europe and the Americas? Well, it's because there's, you know, and they created this thing, right? So there's a perniciousness to it. But there's other forms of power, I think, that are less pernicious. And I think your example about ableism, Matt, is an apt one, where like the built world for able-bodied people didn't necessarily come from an active disdain for disabled bodies.
I know.
Right?
I'm going to build this building to hate disabled people.
Right. This building has stairs because I hate them. Right. And so I think that's important to point out, because sometimes I've heard people chafe under the idea that we should be involved in sort of reparations, that kind of thing, because it's like, well, I don't hate, you know, disabled people, and I don't hate black people. I don't hate, you know, I don't have any personal malevolence towards people. But I think it's important for us to recognize that, like, we can accidentally, or just, you know, in the course of our, you know, living, participate in these things just because we don't notice them, right? So we don't notice ramps because we don't need to use them. But it still is something that for us as Christians, as an act of love to our neighbors who are disabled, maybe we could start paying attention to ramps. Maybe we could allocate some of our budget to make sure that, you know, people in wheelchairs can make it to our worship service. And those kinds of things. So I think it doesn't matter why the injustice exists. I think that part of the call of following Jesus and, you know, being a Christian is to advocate for policies that, you know, include more people in the goodness of life. In general. So.
Yeah.
It's good stuff to chew on.
So we don't take power at the expense of others. We give power to the benefit of others.
Yeah.
Right. And power is not the ability to control, but it's the willingness to give agency and freedom and life.
Yeah.
And flourishing to people.
Yeah.
Yeah. The power of the person you work for now, Christy, isn't measured in whether or not you do what he wants, but rather it's measured in, are you free to operate in your giftedness unto the flourishing of you, your family, and the church?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
I think, go ahead, Ben. Yeah.
I was just going to say one last thing that occurs to me is I think one of the other things that trips us up, and this circles us back to fear. I think one of the reasons that people end up, you know, succumbing to these idols is a belief in scarcity. And so there's in all of these examples, I think there's a belief in abundance, right? And so scarcity of honor might convince your senior pastor, Christy, to say, you know what, I can't afford to compliment another one of these preachers because there's only so much honor to go around here, and I need to keep enough of it for myself so I can maintain my position, right? And so, but his willingness to, you know, affirm you, I think speaks to his belief in abundance to say, well, there's plenty of honor to go around. I can give Christy as much as she can handle, you know, and I'm not losing anything by doing that. And I think that there's a belief in a universe of abundance that God has given us that is required for us to advocate for the flourishing of other people, because otherwise we're always going to feel like we're losing something. Well, yeah. if you gain something, well, I'm losing something. But if I believe in abundance, and if I believe in, you know, God's going to provide for all of our needs. And so that frees us up to advocate for the flourishing of everybody. Because we know, we realize like, well, there's plenty. I'm not losing anything by advocating for your flourishing.
I was chatting with somebody this week about how we do preaching at our church, Christy, just since you brought that up.
Yeah.
Ben and I and Spencer, who co-rector, preach about 12 times a year each. So that's 36 times. But then there's another, 18 times that are preaching other people. We have a team of about 6 or 7 other people that preach. And none of them are credentialed. None of them are in full-time ministry. All they're lay people, right? Mm-hmm. And it's hard. I've got a lot of things to say, Christy Finley.
Yeah.
But there is some kind of cultural artifact where the pulpit is tied to power in a local church.
Yeah.
And if Ben were to preach 40 times and other people 12, that would shape us in a way to understand and hold power, I think, that having lots of people sharing the pulpit doesn't. And so for me, there is a signaling to our community as we share power in that way that you may want us to build this church on a single personality or gift, but we're not doing that here.
Right.
That is not what we're doing. Right?
You are building it on a single God person named Jesus,
but
not on a single person named Benjamin, James, and Matthew, Anthony,
Patrick,
whatever your middle name
is. I love that you stuck with your first guess. You heard what our real middle names were, and you stuck with your first guess anyway.
I know.
So that's amazing.
I'm just going with what I think incredible. It should
be. She likes it. Shows a lot of chutzpah, like Christy LaToya.
Chutzpah. Christy LaToya.
I think there is, I mean, and that's not sufficient. We're not moving mountains. I don't think, but there is something important about that.
Yeah.
For us, it's one of the ways that we try to hold power differently.
Yeah. Many voices. You have this representation of many voices, which is beautiful.
Yeah. Yep. I'll just say one more thing about that too, because that it does, I have a lot to say too. Matt, Christy, a lot to say.
I know.
Things I'd like to say, right? And so, there's a personal discipline there of submitting to this as a way of sharing power. But there's also a belief like that I've come to see there's an abundance as well. Like I've come to actually see that I'm not losing anything by not being able to talk quite as much as I would like. That actually our community and me personally, I benefit from the variety, and that God somehow works through over the course of a year, he works through the various voices, the various preachers, to give this church exactly what this church needs. I've been amazed so many times to hear God speak through somebody who is preaching their first sermon, in front of people, things like that, that happen in our church occasionally that I'm just like, this is incredible. It might not be as polished as somebody who's been preaching for 25 years, but that's not what the sermon's for. It's not for polished speech. It's for God's speech. And they do a wonderful job. And our church hears what we need to hear every year. It's a beautiful thing. And there's an abundance in that. It's like, this is great. This is an incredible thing. So.
Yeah. And just to be clear, it's one of our many attempts to try to creatively undo some of the unhelpful ways that Christians have been formed and shaped to hold power. Right? I think in all of us lives somebody who could or would like want to be the dominant voice in a community, want everybody to listen to them, want people not to argue with them, to fawn over them. I mean, as much as we've organized our churches not to be like that, that still lives in me, which is why I need to be a part of a church that organizes to mitigate against that.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know. I hope these three ways, solidarity and proximity to confront fear, anti-violent power of love to oppose violence, and righteous reparation, working for justice in ways where power has been held unrighteously.
Yeah.
And doing those in discrete, concrete practices and acts. Hopefully this is provoking your imagination to be more creative and feel less hopeless or powerless as you try to confront Christian nationalism.
Yeah. Well, I, for one, have been helped by this conversation. So that's one.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right. Well, that was fun. We haven't done one of these in a while.
Yeah, it's just
the
three of us.
The gang was back together.
Just chatting. So good to be back together, gang. So
we'll
probably be back to a few interviews next week, but yeah, go ahead.
You think so?
Well, I would assume. Based on our editorial calendar. I think we've got interviews coming up. We've got a series coming up on being trauma informed, don't we? A few different interviews.
Yes. Yes, I got to reschedule somebody so we can get on that. But before we go, Christy, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Why doesn't James Bond fart in bed?
I don't know, Matt. Why doesn't James Bond fart in bed?
Because it would blow his cover.
Oh, but
that one was terrible. Just
that's
terrible.
A bad one.
You know what?
That's a really, really bad one.
I do wonder if there isn't a demographic that knows who James Bond is and still finds fart jokes funny, like the 14 and a half year old boy listening to us right now is really liked that joke.
Yeah. Okay, listen, listeners, if you laughed out loud, please let us know. Because if there are zero people that let us know, we're going to can those jokes.
Cancel me.
Wow.
I'm canceled.
Threatening to cancel Matt.
All right.
All right. The gauntlet has been thrown down. Yeah. We'll see.
It's going to come back to bite me. It's going to be like 100 people are going to be like, it was awesome.
We got more emails about that fart joke than anything we've ever gotten before. So,
all right, y'all.
All right, friends.
All right. Peace, y'all. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, we'd love it if you tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
You can join our Gravity community for free. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles that we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our show is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his work at aaronsturkey.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.